From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. There are a lot of different rebel groups in Syria grinding down the regime. Some of them fight to keep the country whole, some to pull it apart, some for democracy, some for an Islamic theocracy. Washington has had a heck of a time figuring out how to help and whom to help, and who, day by day, is on top. This hour On Point, keeping track of the Syrian rebellion. You can join the conversation. Are we doing enough to help the right people in Syria? Should we just let the Assad regime fall whichever way it will, or try to control the outcome? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Beirut in neighboring Lebanon is Noor Malas, correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Noor, nice to have you. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Jane.
So the U.S. is significantly stepping up its support for the Syrian opposition. Secretary of State John Kerry traveled to the region last week, still there actually pledging millions of U.S. dollars in food and medical supplies to Syrian rebels. What is the significance of that aid, Noor?
I think in part this is a reflection of the realities on the ground, because rebels do control a big chunk of territory in the east and north, where the humanitarian situation is just the worst. And to get any aid into these areas efficiently, you have to work with fighters who control border crossings and distribution inside the country. So it's a minor shift for a U.S. administration that has really not wanted to get involved in this at all so far.
Speaking of those fighters, rebels have made significant gains this week, politically and militarily. They just took the city of Raqqa. Could you update us on the fighting?
Yeah, of course. So yesterday, rebel fighters in Raqqa province, which is up in north-central Syria, started taking over parts of the city itself after taking over much of the rest of the wider province. Now, if they manage to keep this, it'll be the first provincial capital they take. It's pretty strategically important. It's on the Euphrates River. It also helps the rebels expand their northern toehold a little bit eastward. But, you know, already today, less than 24 hours after this partial takeover of the city, the regime's fighting back pretty hard already, with residents and activists there reporting pretty bad aerial bombing. So what we're seeing really is the fragmentation of Syria, with opposition fighters consolidating control in the north and the government retaliating when it can with aerial bombardment, recently ballistic missiles, which, you know, some types are notorious for their inaccuracy. And the government focused on keeping control of Damascus, the capital, and Homs and Hama, which are two central cities that offer key supply routes up from the south and from the coast to the capital as well.
So then how do you see Bashar al-Assad's army? Is it in any way about ready to break? Sounds like no.
I mean, this has been the big question for 2 years, but, you know, regardless of reports of the regime retrenching around its Alawite core, and the Alawites are the minority Shiite-linked sect that President Assad and his family are from, a big part of the army is still intact. We've had thousands of defectors, but they've all been lower ranking. You know, there's a pretty formidable Syrian army still following strategic orders and carrying out a really widespread military campaign. The question is whether they're going to continue to carry it out with this ferocity across the country, really.
As far as the political gains, Noor, I'd like you to talk briefly about this extraordinary election held just over the border in Turkey this week with 225 delegates from Syria. What was that all about?
That was a really interesting election because Aleppo is a major front line now. Much of the city that's now in rebel hands has been just destroyed to the ground, really, where there are once homes, hospitals, and bakeries. There's really nothing but rubble now. And what this local council tried to do is elect for the first time through a semi-democratic election, because there was some appointment involved as well, a local council that would both govern the city to try to restore services in the rebel-held parts of the city, and more importantly, try to take back the reins of power from fighting actual armed rebels who have been calling the shots on the ground. So they met in Gaziantep, which is a Turkish border town, and I think it was a lot of fanfare at this event. Mostly all the prominent activists from Aleppo were there, even Sheikh Mu'adh Khatib, who's the head of the major Syrian opposition coalition, went over to bless their elections. Mm-hmm. And they elected a 29-member civilian council that's now responsible for, you know, doing the mundane things, but very important things like getting water and electricity back to neighborhoods, making sure bread distribution is equal and efficient. You know, mm-hmm. people get up at 3 or 4 a.m. to stand in line for bread. And one of the biggest concerns is that some of these Islamist rebel factions have been becoming very good at local services as well. So they're not only just fighting groups, they're local social groups as well.
Hmm. So what about the rise of these Islamist groups? How big of a concern is that, Noor?
So this is an issue that really frustrates Syrians, because on the opposition side, activists blame the rise of these elements on two things. The first is the regime, which for years in the past, during the Iraqi insurgency, for example, helped facilitate the movement and growth of these Islamist networks, which is actually something that not a lot of people pay attention to. And now these are the same Islamists who have taken up the anti-regime cause and are fighting with the rebels, ultimately hijacking at least part of the uprising. And activists also blame the world for not backing the opposition and allowing this thing to drag on and extremists to bubble up. Now, have Islamists gained steam in the opposition? Absolutely. They have access to much more reliable, partly global network of funding, while the pipeline getting to what we like to call the secular-minded rebels seems to be very much on and off. But whether this is reversible, what kind of sway they're going to hold, you know, in a post-Assad Syria, these are all open questions.
Noor Malas reports for The Wall Street Journal. She's in Beirut, Lebanon today. Noor, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thanks.
Well, joining me now from Chicago is Omar Hosino. He is a researcher with the Middle East Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He traveled to Syria in January and met with different rebel groups. To read his article about his trip, go to our website, onpointradio.org. It's nice to have you with us, Omar.
Hi, Jane.
So before we get into what you saw in your recent visit, help us with Syria 101 here. Give us the basics, the ABCs of these different ethnic and religious groups that make up Syria. It's very complicated, but simplify it for us.
Well, Syria is about two-thirds Sunni Arab, about 10% Sunni Kurd, with the remaining minorities being Alawites, which are 10% of the country, the sect of the president, Bashar al-Assad. And also Christians, Druze, Yazidis, other really small groups, Ismailis, that make up the country.
So as I understand it, experts worry about a couple of things, that these different ethnic and religious groups will go after each other. Some of that obviously is already happening. And that the jihadis who are flowing into Syria to join the fight, some from al-Qaeda, will end up taking over the country. I mean, we hear Noor talking about the Islamic networks hijacking the uprising here. So, but you saw several key examples on your trip of groups that are actively pushing in the other direction, pushing a non-sectarian, moderate, democratic vision, a nationalist spirit, you say, is actually still alive, that spirit that initially sparked the revolution, right? It's still alive and well in Syria?
For sure, Jane. You know, I saw what I would describe as the anti-sectarian movement in Syria, or the non-sectarian movement in Syria. Now, while it's not the dominant force on the ground, it's a significant force. It's a strong force. I met with civil society groups, non-violent protest groups, different minorities who work secretly or publicly to help the different rebels. I met rebel forces who are openly secular, who espouse secular principles or civil principles. And I even met religious leaders, moderate Sunni religious leaders, who were either for a secular state, some of them, or others for a civil state, an anti-sectarian constitution, a parliament that represents all groups, as well as groups that I would call, you know, proto-rule of law, you know, police forces that were starting up Sharia courts, which, you know, some are better than others, but some were, you know, I would say a force for rule of law, and different mediation groups which come in and try to mediate between the different communities. You know, Syria is a large country, and we have many cities within this revolution. Three of them I'll cite, you know, Salamiye in the center of the country, Yabrud near Damascus, and Ras al-Ain on the Turkish border, which are actually actually majority minorities and have been with the revolution since the beginning, have been protesting nonviolently. And, you know, although the role of these groups gets, you know, less and less as the revolution goes on and the radicals gain power, they're still active and they're still on the ground.
So we have a minute left before our break here, but tell us very briefly about this nonviolent protest movement in Syria called the Tajja Nabda. Is that, did I say that correctly?
Tajemmu' Nabd. Tajemmu' Nabd is a group founded by an Alawite from Homs who actually goes out and tries to stop sectarianism within the protests. You know, they've held up signs in different cities which say, you know, before you call for a massacre, remember what you felt like when you saw the regime killing people. You know, before you call for sectarian revenge.
Right.
You know, in Zabadani, a city, you know, close to the border with Lebanon, and in Homs, Nabd activists dressed up as Santa Claus. And on Christmas, they went to the Christians in these areas and gave them Christmas presents dressed up as Santa Claus, saying, "This is from the revolutionaries to the Christians of Homs. You are part of us. We are part of you. We are all together." And this movement, you know, has bases all over the country, in Khaldi, in Homs, in the city of Salami, in the city of Yabrud, in the city of Zabadani. And these activists, while, you know, not the most in number, have really been trying to stop sectarianism growing within the revolution.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about which factions in the Syrian rebellion are gaining ground and whether and how the U.S. should be helping the rebels. On Monday, rebel forces took control of the northern city of Raqqa. Here you can hear the sounds on the streets there as crowds tore down a statue of the late Hafez Assad al-Assad, who founded the current regime. My guest this hour is Omar Hosino, a researcher at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, who traveled to Syria in January and saw some signs for hope that more democratically non-sectarian-minded rebel groups may prevail after the regime falls. Omar, you tell us about one. You told us about one of those groups before the break. Give us another example, because minority and secular youth are only one part of the sectarian revolutionary movement. You told us about that. Religious leaders also play a prominent role. Tell us about these two sheikhs who've teamed up.
So I met the Sheikh Abul Huda al-Husseini, who is the director of endowments in Aleppo before defecting in August 2011. He was a very popular cleric in Halab, in Aleppo, and he'd actually defected to Turkey. I met him in Iskenderun, and he's created this new national bloc, is what he calls it, with another sheikh, a very famous sheikh, Sheikh Muhammad al-Yaqubi, a cleric out of Damascus, who actually attacked the regime in a famous sermon in May 2011 and joined the revolution since the beginning. And both of them have been really pushing hard, making this bloc to push the religious people not to have revenge against the Alawites and against different minorities when the regime falls. Both have been opposed to the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafi groups, the more conservative radical groups. And both are showing a vision, you know, for a post-Assad Syria, which is very moderate. You know, the National Bloc in their charter says that they would like to return the Syrian constitution to the constitution of 1950, which is a very moderate constitution. When I met Husseini in Iskenderun, Turkey, he told me, you know, we want a parliamentary system and we want representation for all groups, even the atheists. He said, you know, this is an Islamic principle that everyone gets to say, everyone gets to be heard. He's told me that, you know, Syria is not ready for Islamist rule. He said, while we're Muslims and good religious Muslims, these people claim to use the religion to rule over people. And these two clerics are pushing for a moderate state. You know, Sheikh Al-Yaqubi has said, you know, his understanding of the way Islam works with the state is closer to the Western concept of secularism. And they're not alone. There's another sheikh, Sheikh Murshid al-Ghaznawi. He's actually one of the most famous sheikhs in Syria. He's the biggest sheikh in the northeast of the country, near Iraq. And he has a very famous Sufi order, the Ghaznawi order, and has students of Arabs and Kurds. He's a Kurdish sheikh. And he's explicitly come out and said the constitution of Syria has to be secular. We must push for secularism. And he's pushing the people who follow him and listen to his religious teachings to push a secular state in the country that's moderate.
Even some Sharia courts, Omar, are showing some surprising non-sectarian trends, no?
Yes, that's absolutely the case. You know, not all Sharia courts are created equal. You know, I visited two. I visited one in Bab al-Salami border crossing, and I visited another sheikh, the head of the Sharia and law division of the Idlib city council, Sheikh Abu Jamal. And I found, you know, two different types of courts. The Idlib court was very good, although it did have some problems. You know, everyone had the right to a lawyer. There was innocence until being proven guilty. Due process had to be followed. There were three judges. All three had to agree that you were guilty to be guilty. There was a human rights activist and a sheikh, an Islamic scholar, who had to be witnesses to the trial and could object at any moment. You know, but there are some problems, you know, like the judges. Who elects the judges? I asked them and I really pressed them hard. They said the judges are revolutionary judges who split with the regime, who are elected by a small group of revolutionaries. You know, this is very biased justice, you know. So this is a defect. Another defect is that, you know, they just don't have the capacity to have appeals in an appeals court. Mm. So there was no appeals court.
Right.
You know, other courts are not so good. You know, some courts don't have these protections. The court in Bab al-Salami crossing, there was another Sheikh Abul Huda there who ran that. You know, there were no real due process rule of law. It was more of an inquisition type court. So some of these have the early signs of rule of law, others don't.
So still spotty, but what was your overall take on your trip there, Omar?
Well, you know, I believe there's still some very, very good signs. You know, there are some disturbing signs. I met people in the refugee camps who did have sectarian things to say. You know, people who said, why did Bashar send his Alawite community to kill us? People who said, you know, those Shiites came from Fu'a, a village in Idlib, to come hurt us and kill us. But, you know, there's also some very hopeful signs. I met one man named Mahmoud Hussein, who's creating these militants ready to protect the peace in Aleppo. And what he's doing is he's combining these civil groups and these courts and these nonviolent activists with brigades, and having these brigades protect security in different neighborhoods in Aleppo from both the regime and the jihadists and the PYD, which is a PKK-linked group in the city. I met others. There's militant groups. I met a brigade called the Salahuddin Brigades, which is a Kurdish brigade. And I asked them, are you for an Islamic state? And they said, we are for secularism. You know, the Kurds are very known to be more secular in Syria. And he said, as Kurds, we can be the bridge between the Sunnis and we can be a bridge between the minorities and be that moderate force. You know, he told me, he said, I swear to God, we are the Free Syrian Army for all Syrians. If someone comes to try to kill the Alawites, we're going to have to start a battle and we're going to have to fight the jihadists and defend the Alawites because we have to defend all Syrians. Well, and so these are all hopeful signs. You know, these yeah. people are still there.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like there's some innovation going on for sure in some difficult circumstances. Omar Hosseini, thank you very much for your time today. I really appreciate the perspective that you had on your recent trip. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Omar is a researcher at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And I'd like now to move on to Washington and hear from Steve Heidemann. He's senior advisor for Middle East initiatives at the United States Institute for Peace. He ran the Institute's Day After project, which brought together Syrian exiles to try to develop plans to help Syria transition to peace and democracy, not civil war. Stephen, welcome.
Hi, Jane.
So how strong do you think the tolerant, moderate, non-sectarian culture is inside Syria right now? What did you make of what Omar saw during his visit?
Well, I think what both Omar and Noor made clear is that we not only have a struggle in Syria between the opposition and the regime, but we have a struggle within the opposition to define the future of Syria. And there have been conflicting trends, some of which, as Omar mentioned, are more hopeful, others of which are more disturbing. The conflict has become increasingly sectarian. Armed groups have become increasingly militant in the kind of sectarianism and Islamic identity that they articulate. And so we can anticipate that these groups are going to try to shape Syria's political future and to impose a more Islamic, more sectarian profile on Syrian politics in the future. They will resist efforts to create a civil state. They will resist efforts to give religious minorities equality of citizenship. But the degree of pushback that those groups are encountering tells us that they cannot take for granted, and we should not take for granted, that Syria is doomed to a future of sectarian militancy and sectarian violence. There are a number of trends, and Omar mentioned them with much more detail than I could, that make explicit just how powerful and how broad some of these anti-sectarian trends are. We do tend to see that right now the guys with the guns are increasingly sectarian, increasingly militant. And I think we have to be aware that the pushback is coming from groups that typically are not as well armed, are often less well organized, less well funded, and operate at something of a disadvantage. But nonetheless, I think we have a very strong possibility in Syria to avoid the kind of outcomes we've seen in some other settings, where politics after an uprising, after a revolution, did consolidate along sectarian lines and did give rise to more militant sectarian identities.
And I
think there are.
And I want to hear exactly what you've done about that in just a moment. But first, Stephen, I want to play some sound from Secretary of State John Kerry. He held a joint news conference in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, yesterday with the Saudi foreign minister. Saudi Arabia is providing arms as well as non-lethal aid to the rebels. And a reporter asked Kerry whether he worried that the guns the Saudis are providing will fall into the wrong hands. In other words, the hands of the jihadists.
There is no guarantee that one weapon or another might not at some point in time fall into the wrong hands. But I will tell you this, that there is a very clear ability now in the Syrian opposition to make certain that what goes to the moderate, legitimate opposition is in fact getting to them.
And then Senator John McCain was interviewed Friday on CBS This Morning, and he said that a woman he met with recently in a refugee camp told him that if the U.S. does not help Syrian rebels militarily, they will turn to extremists for help. And as a result, the children in those camps would grow up to be jihadists. He says, "We are raising a generation of jihadists." That's what McCain declared. And then the CBS anchorman, Charlie Rose, asked McCain how he could be sure American-supplied arms would not fall into the hands of the jihadists.
Do you worry that if, in fact, they supply lethal weapons, they could fall into the hands of the wrong forces and therefore be used against?
If we had a safe zone, we could control that. And right now, weapons are flowing into the wrong people, Charlie, and they're flowing in from, frankly, some of our friends in the Gulf states, including some wealthy Saudis. They are. And these jihadists are having more and more influence as time goes by. Everything that they said would happen if we intervened has happened because we didn't intervene, and it's shameful.
So, Stephen Heideman, there's Senator McCain saying it's shameful that the U.S. has not intervened more. Arming the rebels still remains off the table. What should the U.S. be doing? Should we be involved more in Syria?
I think Secretary Kerry is working to bring about a shift in U.S. policy that would broaden U.S. engagement in the Syrian conflict in ways that we would hope would accelerate the end of the conflict, that would put sufficient pressure on the Assad regime that it would either enter negotiations or that the rebels would move close enough to a military victory that they would be able to determine the political future of Syria, perhaps unilaterally, without negotiation. And I think what Senator Kerry said is important to pay attention to, because he underscored that our earlier concern about what might happen if the U.S. were to become more directly involved has now been overtaken by the negative consequences that are a direct result of U.S. absence, of the failure of the U.S. to play a more direct role in the conflict. And I should say by direct, I don't mean direct intervention. I mean broadening the kinds of support we provide to the opposition, including the armed opposition. As Senator McCain said, we worried a lot about what would happen if we moved our policy in that direction. And everything that we worried about has come to pass. And it has come to pass, in at least in part, because of the continued ability of the Assad regime to impose violence and use very brutal means to repress and attack citizens.
Stephen Heideman, let me get some listeners into this conversation. Khalil is first up. He's in Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, Khalil. Welcome to On Point. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, Jen.
Hello, go ahead.
Hi, Jen. I am Jordanian. Originally, my mother is Syrian. My wife is Syrian from city of Latakia, northeast on the Mediterranean. First, I would like to express my sympathy to all of these people, children, women, you name it, who died in vain. Yes, they died in vain. 70,000 plus. It's not time to blame who killed them. They got killed by two sides, savagely, burned, killed, cut, you name it. My only comment about the whole thing, United States should not interfere at all. Either they go 100% or they stay aside, because the problem in Syria, it's not only about Syria. United States established a government in Iraq for the last 12 years. Yes, it could be worse than Saddam himself, but it's a government. We should keep it in contact. And if the Sunni win in Syria, kiss that government goodbye, because it's a Sunni in Iraq. Lebanon, you're going to have Christian Muslims fight to the bone. North of Syria, Christians, which is I am one of them, my family Christian, and all my mother's family Christian in that city, we are scared to death. Me and my family scared to death. Not from the revolutionaries. We worry from the situation. What's going to happen if we fall apart?
What's going to happen next? Khalil, thank you very much. Stephen Heidemann, you know, there's Khalil, a Syrian, saying, U.S., stay out. I mean, it's the 10th anniversary coming up of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. I guess U.S. and Syrian rebels seeing Iraq as a cautionary tale, no?
Well, I'm afraid I see things a little bit differently than Mr. Khalil. I certainly understand his point of view. But I think the greatest threat to regional stability and the greatest possibility for spillover of violence from Syria into Iraq, into Lebanon, as he was suggesting, will arise from the continuation of the conflict and from the escalation of the conflict and the deepening of these sectarian trends within the conflict. And if there are opportunities through a carefully modulated strategy of intervention on the part of the U.S., supplying aid, supplying training, supplying weapons, but no direct intervention, along lines that will shorten the conflict, it seems to me that the U.S. can play a role in helping to avoid the outcomes that Mr. Khalil was so worried about. And I don't think that we should permit the legacies of Iraq or the legacies of our experience in Afghanistan to blind us to the possible risks of remaining so passive, relatively speaking, as the Syrian conflict deepens.
I have a lot of listeners here on Facebook who've written, Stephen, here's Mitch, I see a continuation of Iraq and Afghanistan in Syria, unstable countries with many different players, but the ones with the money to organize the country will be the ones who we disagree with. Here's another that says America reaching again, overreaching. Another that says Afghanistan 2.0, good news for weapons manufacturing. A lot of folks against America reaching in and stepping in Syria, Stephen.
I would simply invite those listeners to look at the trajectory of the Syrian conflict thus far. The things they're concerned about are happening. If we have a chance to stop them, I think we should consider how we might do so without direct U.S. intervention on the ground.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the Syrian rebellion and about who is going to come out on top this hour. You can join the conversation. What do we, the United States and the world, owe the Syrian people? And what do you make of U.S. allies like Saudi Arabia allowing money to flow not to democratically minded rebel groups, but to al-Qaeda type groups? My guest this hour is Stephen Heidemann. He's the senior advisor for Middle East initiatives at the United States Institute of Peace and has been leading the Institute's Day After project, which hopes to help Syrian rebels build an orderly, peaceful country out of the ruins of the Assad regime and avoid the chaos we all saw in Iraq after the fall of Saddam Hussein. And joining me now from Norman, Oklahoma, is Joshua Landis, director of the Center for Mideast Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He runs the must-read blog, SyriaComment.com. It's nice to have you with us, Josh.
It's a pleasure to be there.
Before I start with you, let me play this clip. Here's Senator John McCain, Republican of Arizona, on CBS This Morning. This is last Friday. He is saying that the United States has not done enough to help Syria's rebels.
The Iranian Revolutionary Guard have people on the ground. Weapons are flowing in from Russia and from Iran. Surrounding countries are being destabilized. We're now nearly 2 years, 70,000 people, estimates have been massacred. And I appreciate John Kerry's efforts. I really do. But to say that we are really going to change the equation with non-lethal aid isn't going to do it. And I think we have written a shameful chapter in American history.
Joshua Landis, what's your position? Should the U.S. be doing a little more to help the rebels in Syria?
You know, the U.S. should be giving a lot more money than it's giving. It's giving about a quarter of a billion dollars so far. The rebels want $62 billion, and we could go up, you know, to a lot more. But the real problem here, seems to me, is that it's trying to define who are the Syrians. And as we've heard from the top of this program, Noor described the seculars versus the Islamists. Other people have talked about moderates. John Kerry didn't use secular because the question is whether it's seculars or moderates that we want to be backing. But the notion is that there's good guys and bad guys in Syria, and America should be helping the good guys and picking the winners. My fear is that the United States, that Syria is much more Islamic than the United States wants it to be. If we go in and try to pick winners, we're going to pick the secular people who are a minority. And we could prolong that fight in a way that Khalil, the Christian from Latakia, underlined, is that by trying to pick the winners, we're going to get into a struggle that's going to suck other people in, and it could prolong the situation.
So time is the key element here, then. The moderate forces may have a better chance of running the country if Assad falls today rather than if the war drags on and on for another few years?
But America would have to go all in. You know, if America goes all in, that's fine and sort of insists on who it wants to rule. If it's just going to give a little bit of aid to the people it wants to rule, we've got mission creep that's begging to happen because the Islamists are going to go in further, and it's going to turn into a civil war. That's, you know, it's going to, you know, we're going to want our people to win against the Islamists, and the Islamists may be a majority. We may be preventing a solution rather than helping peace. That's the difficulty because we don't know what the real character of Syrian society is, and we're going in there in order to skew it in our favor, which is the more seculars. And that may be good for America. Is it good for Syria? Not necessarily clear. We went into Iraq, and we made a very clear win for the Shiites, cast the Sunnis down to the bottom. Today, the Sunnis are on the warpath. They're joining al-Qaeda because we skewed the society too much in one direction, perhaps. This is the danger of America going in to secure its interests in the region. We're putting it in the name of the interests of Syria, but it's not clear that it's in the interests of the majority of Syrians.
Let's get a listener in here from Worcester, Massachusetts. George is on the line. George, welcome to the program. Hello.
Yes. How you doing?
Hello. Well, go ahead.
Okay. I'm Syrian. I am from city of Latakia. I am scared to death. I call my family every other day to check on them. They're scared to death. Those jihadists, they're all from all over the world. They're going to Syria to fight their own war. We really don't like this kind of democracy they try to impose on us. If we really want to do some democracy, we should just talk to the Saudis or the Gulf countries in general. We're in Syria, I'll tell you the truth. We are religious a little bit extra. And I think we're going to... We should remember, like 5-6 years ago, George Bush, remember that, be careful what you wish for when we talk about democracy, then Hamas won the Gaza Strip. And here we have same way.
Can I ask you a question, George? I hear what you're saying. I am curious about your family who's in Syria right now, how they feel about Assad. At the beginning of the revolution, many people wanted a change of government. And now I'm seeing a lot of reports that perhaps they don't, that they worry more about who might come next and what might come next, who might replace him. Is that what your family's hearing? Is that what you feel?
Well, very close, actually. You put very close. We are not big fan of Assad, but in the same time, we're happy where he is because we have the freedom of practice our own religion. Nobody bothers us. We can go to churches. We have no issues with the other Muslims, like the Alawite or the Sunnis. We have no issues. But right now, it's very, very tense. Like, we cannot talk to any Sunnis anymore because they hate us. They assume we are, I don't know, like we are like a pro-regime or mm-hmm. we are with Assad. But mm-hmm. we are afraid to death because the jihadists, they're going from all over the world.
George,
they want to beheaded us. Like, we are scared. That's not democracy. We don't like this kind of democracy, really.
George, thank you so much. I appreciate your call and that unique perspective. Stephen Heidemann, what do you make of that? Syrians thinking, well, I'm not sure, nervous about what's coming up.
Well, let me go back to what Joshua Linda said. There's a lot that Joshua and I agree on, but we disagree quite fundamentally with respect to his comments this morning. He sketched out a number of worst-case scenarios that I think are perhaps more likely to come about if the West and the United States do nothing than if they begin to participate more broadly, more actively in support of the armed opposition. I think it is completely untrue that the U.S. must go all in or do nothing. I think it is completely untrue that mission creep is inevitable. And I think the idea that it would be very carefully managed but increased U.S. engagement with this conflict that would drive it in a more Islamist direction, that would lead to regional spillover, is completely overlooking the extent to which those trends are already in place. And so I think we need to be very clear that there are options, there are strategies, there are possibilities for the West and the U.S. to shorten this conflict and to reduce the likelihood of those outcomes occurring.
Joshua Landis,
Let me ask you, Steve, if the Islamists begin to win in this fight, will you concede to them or will you double down on the moderate militias and try to beat them? That's my question.
And Josh, I think that's the wrong question. I think the question is, what can be done by the West, by the U.S., to try to shorten the duration of this conflict, to strengthen those groups within the country we agree with, and to create opportunities for a future that looks quite a bit more promising than the one you sketch out. And I don't think that we should concede that there are no possibilities for us to play that kind of a role. I don't think we should concede. I don't think we should be sufficiently arrogant or operate with the notion or the confidence that our influence will direct the course of events on the ground or will inevitably lead to the outcomes we like. We know that's not the case. I don't think that's a reason for not trying.
Joshua Landis, well, you've said
a lot more.
Okay, go ahead.
I think we should do a lot more. The point is that by defining this as moderates versus conservatives or Islamists versus seculars, America enters into a conflict that it's bound to lose in Syria, and it's not good for Syrians. I think that, you know, what most of the Islamists are saying and most of the Syrian rebel groups are saying is that they can work together from very right Islamists that America would reject, or certainly our Congress would reject, to very moderate Islamists, can work together and find a consensus. If America gets in and tries to pick winners, there are many people we're not going to be able to embrace in Syria, and we're going to force a division down the center of these rebel groups, that a division that may be artificial, but that they will go after if they can get American aid, and they will begin to sort themselves out along these lines.
But that suggests, Josh, that what the U.S. will do is increase polarization and increase the divisions between these sides. And I think that we have learned, I would hope we have learned from previous experience, that the most important way to be constructively engaged is to support the efforts of these groups to shape their own political future and to acknowledge and recognize that it may have a character and composition very different than we might prefer ideally, and that we will indeed have to live with a government that may have attributes and qualities that differ significantly from those we would like to see.
Let me get a few more callers in here, gentlemen.
And I think we can do so in Syria.
Let me jump in and bring Sam in from Malden. Go ahead, Sam. You're on Point. Welcome.
Yeah, hey, thanks for taking my call. I think it is important to look at experience. I think You know, we kind of just say what America can do, and this is what we should do. And I'd like to put a little more of a finer point on that. It's not the American people. It's really the Pentagon and the people that advise the Pentagon. So I'd like to first point that out. And my suspicion is that we don't do things for altruistic reasons. We do things for interests, and primarily they're generally economic and corporate interests. So having said that, I would first ask the guests, what are those interests, and why would we want to go into Syria? And as a citizen watching what America is doing in my name, you can't help but look at Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Egypt. We consistently screw things up, to say nothing of Vietnam. We don't get involved in wars. These are, generally speaking, these are efforts that are initiated by the executive government without any oversight. And so I wouldn't trust the American interest.
All right, let me
do the right thing.
Sam, for time's sake, let me turn to our guests and ask them. Joshua Landis, you first. What are our interests in Syria, and what do we need to worry about regionally as this drags on?
Well, that's a very good question, and people don't agree on our interests. There are significant lobby groups in Washington that want to stick it to Iran and destroy Iranian influence in Syria so that Hezbollah will be weakened and Iran will be rolled back. Other people will say that's, you don't want to come in on one side too harshly. We did this in Iraq. We screwed up. Others will say, look, we don't have any traditional long-term interests in Syria. We've had sanctions on Syria since the 70s. We've spent no money, and we have no trade with Syria. We've always seen Syria really as an adjunct to the Arab-Israeli conflict, and we've treated it as such. Syria has helped Hezbollah and Hamas, which are inimical to Israel, and we've hurt Syria for that reason and prescribed it and put sanctions on it so that it would stop supporting. So in some ways, what Washington looks at this revolution, they say, good. If we can get Sunnis to win over the Shiite Alawite government, then they won't be pro-Iran. They'll be pro-Saudi Arabia and Turkey, and they'll be pro-American. And so those are the interests that have been driving this. But America has, economically almost no interests. We're trying to get out of the Middle East. Obama is, to pivot towards Asia. We're trying to carry on delicate negotiations with Iran over nuclear weapons, with Russia over a number of different things. And this is one reason why Obama doesn't want to get into a hot war and start arming, as McCain is suggesting, rebels who are going to be against Iran and against Russia, because it'll get us into sort of a hot war. So those are the concerns in Washington about not getting in.
Joshua, I got to interrupt you because I'm running out of time here, and I need to ask you one question. You've said that that the United States is allied with Al Qaeda in Syria already. What did you mean by that?
We've tried to prescribe Al Qaeda, but we are supporting the revolution broadly. It's in Syria, in a sense, we're in a with it or against it. We're against Assad, and that means arming Sunni rebels to fight him. And when we give arms to the Sunnis, rebels, and many of the rebel commanders have underlined this, they're sharing arms because they're going in as a coalition of different militias. They divide up the arms and they attack. And Jabhat al-Nusra and Ahrar al-Sham and other Islamic Front militias that work with Jabhat al-Nusra trade weapons. They work together. Mm. So in a sense, we're a tacit ally. Turkey. Most of these Jabhat al-Nusra people are coming in through Turkey, our major ally in this. Mm-hmm. There is no border stopping them. We're facilitating, in a sense, not America, but our allies are facilitating the free movement of al-Qaeda in and out of Syria in order to take down Assad. Now, Obama proscribed Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the al-Qaeda organization in Syria. But it hasn't done anything to act on that because there was an outcry from our most loyal supporters in Syria to the Islamists saying that's not fair. This is an all or nothing situation. We're all working hand in glove. They all said we're working together. Right. So, we can claim that we're not supporting it, but of course Al-Qaeda is a tacit ally. And
I got to interrupt you, if you guys got about a minute left, Joshua, and I want to get Stephen Heidemann in here in our last few seconds to tell us about this Day After project that you've been working with, Stephen, to get participants in Syria involved in the independent planning process of what happens after Assad. Can you tell us briefly about that?
I'd love to respond, Jane, to some of the things Joshua said, but I'll resist the impulse and talk a bit about the Day After project. It is a Syrian project, USIP facilitated, but it was designed, managed, led by Syrians themselves. And it lays out options and strategies for working in the field of security sector reform, transitional justice, rule of law, and other areas that are going to be critical in determining what kind of future Syria has. And we were very, very pleased to see, as this project unfolded, the commitment of the participants to a civil state, to notions of citizenship, to building strong state institutions that respected all Syrians, all religions, all nationalities and ethnicities. And we very much hope as we move forward that it becomes a basis for planning by the Syrian opposition itself.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate both your perspectives. I'm sorry we had to intervene so often. Time is ticking away. Stephen Heidemann, Senior Advisor for Middle East Initiatives at the United States Institute of Peace. Thank you very much for your perspective, Stephen.
Thank you.
And Joshua Landis, joining us from Norman, Oklahoma. He's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He's got a must-read blog on Syria called SyriaComment.com. Joshua, I appreciate your time as well. Thank you.
Pleasure being with you.
Coming up tomorrow, did Eric Cantor kill the deal that could have avoided the sequester? We'll go inside a big new profile of the House Majority Leader with The New Yorker's Ryan Lizza. That's tomorrow. For today, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.